Before I go to our opening words, I want to make the invitation that will be the substance of much of our service today. In your order of service, each of you received an index card, and hopefully you all have something to write with. And if you would write down in very clear letters whatever question you would like me to address during the homiletic portion of our service, I will do my best to get to all of them. I will look under my chair if anyone thinks that I missed theirs. A couple years ago, some of you may remember Carolyn Burr had a question that ended up under my chair, became a whole sermon then later in the fall. But do me this favor when you're writing them out, don't fold them up. It makes them very hard to deal with. So sometime between now and very nearly in the future, we'll be collecting these cards. So you want to go ahead and get your question down. And that means there's not that much time, so don't make them compound and complex questions. Just questions that you would like addressed, if you would. Okay? I invite you to join me in the spirit of prayer. Spirit of life-giving love and love-giving life. Spirit of living in the question that we might not be mired in it, but inspired by it. Not knowing where we come from or where we are going to, we do know that we are here. We know that we are here, that we are together, that we have the capacity to love, to heal, and to be healed. We are here, and what we do while we're here matters. We are here that we might find and make meaning in our lives. On a warm summer morning, or in the aftermath of a storm, in a struggle for wholeness, or in the satisfaction of a job well done. May we each be touched by the spirit that we are here to seek, that we might be all the more aware, all the more intentional, and thus relieved, because we have found in all of that the hope that we need to take the next step. Let us hold this moment together in quiet. Amen.
Our first reading is from the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, translated by Stan Rosenthal. One who seeks wisdom is well advised to give up academic ways and put an end to striving. Then he will learn that yes and no are distinguished only by distinction. It is to the advantage of the sage that he does not fear with what others fear, but it is to the advantage of others that they can enjoy the feast or go walking free of hindrance through the terraced park in spring. Our second reading is Being Human. It's a meditation from the collection Dancing in the Empty Spaces, published by Skinner House Books. To be human is to be touched with the larger rhythms and harmonies of the universe. To be human is to be aware of the beauty of a creation that continually unfolds. To be human is to be servants of the earth upon which our existence depends. To be human is to embrace the present moment as a sacred, joyful occasion. To be human is to nurture bridges of intimacy that are global and inclusive. To be human is to be in a state of process, to live, to love, and to never die.
So I have to make a disclaimer as I begin, and that is that I have no intention of answering your questions. It will be my hope to address them in some kind of meaningful way that speaks to you in your question. And of course, the answer will be left to you to determine. Over the years, I've had questions that have ranged from where do socks go when they disappear in the dryer, to what is the most important thing we need to remember as human beings? And I think that we end up covering pretty close to that full range here this morning. It's also not my intention to finish by 11 o'clock. So if you have to go somewhere at 11 o'clock, I'm sorry. Go ahead and go, but we'll just finish them. The first two go together as bookends, I believe, and I don't know if the people were sitting next to each other or how this communication occurred, but the first question is there a heaven? If there is a heaven, what and where is it? And the second one is not really a question, but a statement. There is heaven in the sky. And I suspect that the second one, there is heaven in the sky, was probably intended to be the question, is there heaven in the sky? And I don't know about that. But here's what I know, and that is that heaven is something that is possible, and love is the environment of heaven. And when we are in sync between our innermost selves and our outermost world, we are probably as close to heaven as I imagine being able to experience, with one caveat. On this past Thursday, I was riding my bicycle in the mountains out in Sussex County, and I was coming down a slight grade, and the wind was blowing in my face, and the sun was shining, but not so hot. And my thought in that moment was, this is heaven. This is heaven. So there was something of love in that experience, and whatever, wherever heaven is, I know that love has something to do with its environment. Could you please share how you maintain your optimistic approach to life in the face of so much world strife, domestic violence, and climatic change? I want to quote a book by Carol Pearson. I'm struggling to remember her name. Carol Pearson wrote a book on archetypes. And in one of her schemas of archetypes, a person begins as a fool and ends up as a magician, begins naive and innocent and ends up all-knowing. And the point for Carol Pearson is that we can not know what's going on in the world and be full of bliss because of the lack of our knowledge, or when we are open to knowledge and aware of the world, we can still love the world, but holding in that love all of the pain and suffering and brokenness that exists in our lives and in the world around us. And I don't know if I'm personally born fortunate. Some people have no issue at all being thin all their lives. I do. I have an issue with that. For me, it's difficult to remain down about the world situation because there's too much opportunity for joy at the same time. And it's not about denying the pain or the brokenness. It's about knowing that they're there and doing what we can do to address them. Despair is a place where I just don't want to spend time, and I hope you don't want to spend any more than you have to there. What is optimism? These were closely related questions to you. To reframe what I said, I think optimism is knowing what is real and still having hope for the possibility of love in our future. How would you define transcendence or grace? There's another one that's going to come up later that's similar to this. I didn't get them together, though, when I was reading through them. How would you define transcendence or grace? And I would say this, that in my theology, I begin with the idea that being born, being human, is an experience that involves traumatic separation from all that is, and so our very existence begins in significant pain, and that the possibility that we have in our lives is to learn how to live through that pain, transcending that pain, and becoming something more than that pain in the world. And I think that transcendence is the process by which we move through our pain, and that grace is those gifts that are given to us that help us to move through that. Maybe the grace of riding down a mountainside. Maybe the grace of a door opening where we thought one was closed. Maybe the grace of being offered forgiveness when we thought there was none. Maybe grace is finding in our hearts the capacity to forgive when we didn't believe that we could. Knowing that agnostics/atheists are welcome, what does the concept of Unitarianism have to say to them? And I think what it has to say is that we are a part of something much larger than ourselves, and we all identify and name that largeness in whatever ways we will. And some of us use theological terms to identify that largeness, and some of us use very natural terms, some of us use humanist terms, and some of us use divine terms. And it doesn't matter to us here what terms work for you. What matters to us here is that we recognize that we're part of something larger than ourselves, and that in that largeness we have our being, and in that being we have the capacity to be filled with awe, to be filled with gratitude, and to respond with service. How does one converse with a GLBT person? How does one convince a GLTB person that they are welcome to UU Montclair? This would be a very good one for each of you to answer yourselves. I would hope that any LGBT person walking in the door would recognize that they are here on a quest just as everyone else is, that their sexual orientation probably has little to do with that quest other than that it gives it the specifics in which the quest is grounded. And so how we would convince someone is by being aware that we live in a homophobic society and know that we need to pay attention to the language that we use. And in the way that we are being welcoming. Maybe the first question we ask a visitor who comes in alone is, oh, if it's a woman, oh, are you married? Oh, is your husband coming as well? Or, you know, there are lots of questions that we ask that we think are really questions but say so much about the assumptions that we have. And so a way that we can be welcoming is to be very aware of the assumptions that are present in the questions that we ask and in the way we welcome people. Of the principles and purposes of Unitarian Universalism, which one speaks to you the most? I can't answer that. There are two that speak to me the most, and they do because they are in balance with one another, and they are the first and the seventh. We affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and we affirm and promote the interdependent web of existence of which we are a part. The other five principles are bridges that lead from number one to number seven and from number seven back to number one for me. And what that has to do with and why they are in balance is because we begin with the one and we end with the many. And to be in balance, we have to be as much about the one as we are about the many. The word religion, an early religious word that comes out of Sanskrit, it comes from two Sanskrit words. The word Hebrew comes from the Sanskrit words hab paru, which means the one and the many. So from the very earliest of religious experience, religion has been about the quest and the learning of who we are and what that means as we discover our relationships in the one and the many. So both of those together. Why is it that we as humans return to our struggles, restore health, return to struggle, become restored to health? Because that's our story. Because none of us are going to get out of this alive, and because our lives are filled with little deaths, our lives are filled with little setbacks and sometimes great setbacks. And you know, if we died the instant after we were born, we would have faced none of that. But the natural course of life has us dying and being reborn all along the way, and it would not be the human experience, I think, if it were otherwise. What are your hopes for us as a congregation? Thank you for asking that. My hopes for us as a congregation, I would say, is that we do what we do so well that other people will recognize that here they might find a religious and spiritual path that can speak to them in ways that will allow them to transcend the pain of the human experience and make meaning out of their lives. There are other religious messages out there that do their messages very well and that are very inviting for people with very sure answers to the questions of life. And we don't have answers to the very sure questions of life. What we have is the capacity to face those questions together and then to be with one another as we face them every day. And so my hope for us as a congregation is that we will do the things we do so well that people will recognize a welcome here for them, and that we will create programs that will help to make justice in our community and in our world. So my hope is that we continue to do everything that we do and that we just do it better and better. Why are we here today? And I would say, the question that I would ask in response to your question is, why are you here today? That's yours and not mine. How do you explain the Unitarian Universalist faith to a friend of another faith? And you need to find words that are comfortable for you in doing this. You know, there's the short answers that you have the opportunity in the elevator to share with other people, and then there are opportunities where you can speak at some amount of length. And I think speaking at some amount of length, many of us are already capable of doing that. But how do we, in a concise way, share the significance of Unitarian Universalism? And I've come across language just within the last couple of years that I've been finding very comfortable, and perhaps sometime it will change, but for now the language that I use is, especially if I'm talking to someone who is a practitioner of another faith, is, in your faith and in many faiths, the focus is on the individual's relationship with a creator. And for me, in our faith, the primary focus is on a person's relationship with creation. And the relationship with any creator will take care of itself. But we are here to be engaged in creation and to be about the work of making, of doing our part in creation. What is the role of prayer here at UUCM? Lanre Call was a colleague of mine, no longer alive, who would say, prayer doesn't change things, prayer changes people, and people change things. And prayer, when I offer prayer, is about changing my heart as much as I can. When I pray with the congregation, my hope always is that it's about changing our hearts, opening our hearts, enlarging our hearts to be engaged in this life, to feel the healing that's there and possible for us, and so that we might be more intentional, so that we have a transformative kind of experience. Many of you may not know that during the interlude, just before I deliver any sermon, I'm back there praying. And my prayer is giving myself permission to be in touch with whatever text or topic I have come with. My prayer is that I will be in touch with you as a congregation as that's being delivered, and that I can then let go of whatever might get in the way of being in touch with the message and being in touch with you. And I give myself permission to do that, and I always end it with, and I am so willing to accept any help that might be here for me in accomplishing that. What is the nature and purpose of worship in the absence of faith in a supreme being? I take Ralph Waldo Emerson's charge to the minister as my primary definition of worship. And what Ralph Waldo Emerson said was that it's the task of the preacher to lift up the events of the day so that the people can see those events through the lenses of their religious sensibilities and principles. And, you know, and my addition to Emerson's piece there is, to what end? To the end that we might know better who we are in relationship to the events of our day, so that we can be more intentional in that relationship. Or, in another way of saying it, so that the possibility of transformation is being held open and you can recognize wherever and however and whatever that transformation might mean for you. The topic of transcendence, how we live it and understand it today, everything that I've said already, plus I think transcendence always means moving from someplace to someplace larger. This is the socks in the dryer question. Why not have a diagonal path across the front lawn here at the UU? I don't know why not. I only know that we don't have one. And I put those signs up saying, please don't walk on the grass. If there's a sidewalk, the signs wouldn't say, please don't walk on the sidewalk. Maybe nobody thought of it before this morning. I don't know. The UU denomination is actively involved in many political issues for churches, etc. Where does the line fall with regard to separation of church and state? I just spent 12 hours yesterday in the annual retreat of the Unitarian Universalist Legislative Ministries Group of New Jersey, a question that we are constantly facing in UULMNJ. And there are some very concise answers to the question. One thing is, you don't talk about candidates from the pulpit. And another thing is, you sure can talk about any issue that you want to from the pulpit. Issues are what Emerson said we should be lifting up. And so to talk about issues is a part of what we are here to do to begin with. The IRS allows for 20% of a 501c3 to go to specific political causes, but not more than 20%. So for UULMNJ, the 501c3 aspect of that organization, we try to keep it at about 18 or 19% so we don't surprise ourselves sometime by, oh, that was that. And the same is true for us here. When we open our space to a candidate who's running for an office, we are open then to any other candidate who would like to come here and speak if they're running for that office. We try to, in terms of the politics of things, the partisan politics of things, to have as open a dais as we can maintain, at the same time maintaining that there are values that we share that come out of our principles, and that it's our task to see how the events of the day relate to those principles. And does that answer that one? No? Okay. It does. He changed his mind. Okay, so if Mitt Romney becomes president, how will his Mormon religion affect our lives and our church life? So that's anybody's guess, huh? I mean, you know, if you ask Mitt Romney, based on anything he has done at any time in his life, what he's going to do next, his answer would be, well, I don't know. I'll have to see when I get there. And so my guess is, you know, he's gonna keep Mormonism as far out of the spotlight of this campaign, and I won't make any predictions about how the campaign is going to turn out as I stand here in this pulpit, but I don't know that we'll have an enormous opportunity to see just how that comes to play. Why isn't the UU faith more influential in the United States and in the world? That's a good question, isn't it? Here's what I think. I think that people come to Unitarian Universalism having, for the most part, found your way here. You find your way here. And so you come the first time I attended a service, I was invited to a wedding. My mouth dropped open during the course of that wedding. This is a religious community? That's incredible. This is my religious home. I knew that in that wedding. I knew that. Why aren't we more influential? I think because we are so afraid of appearing like evangelical, proselytizing other religions, that we fail to invite people to come and find joy in what we have found. And I think if we're going to be influential to the extent that we can in our communities and in our country and in our world, it will be because our members are doing with this place like what they do with a really good restaurant that they discover. What is the UU position on conscientious objectors? Can individual congregations differ on that? One of our principles says that we affirm and promote an individual. Somebody open the hymnal and read that particular one. The first and last I have memorized, but that we nourish individual spiritual growth and the right of conscience, freedom of conscience. The one before that. Free and responsible search for truth and meaning. And so what is the UU position on conscientious objectors is, if you are a conscientious objector, we support you. If you are someone who... If you're someone who feels called to military service and going into the Army or one of the other branches of the service, we support you. I personally am a conscientious objector, and that was a process that I found myself involved in during the Vietnam War back in the 1960s. At this time, we don't have anyone from this congregation who's off in Afghanistan or in Iraq serving in the military, but a year ago we had two people, and their names were mentioned probably 2 or 3 weeks out of every 4 weeks during our remembrances as we held them in our thoughts and in our prayers, and we had some special sending off of them as they went. So it's about what you have to do because of what you firmly believe, you know, what your conscience makes you conscientious of, and we support that. Of the five elements, which one resonates most with you? Earth, mind, fire, water, or sky? Well, I have to say that I'm a Virgo, and that's an earth sign, and while all the other ones are good, it's the earth that holds me here, and it's of the earth that I am made, and I guess earth. I've never considered this before. I like them all a lot. But if I've got to pick a favorite, you know, if I have to pick a favorite, I love all the seasons. If I have to pick a favorite season, it's got to be autumn. Why? Because of the earth tones that are all around us during autumn. What is the UU? Oh, we did that. How can we love and tolerate people like Todd Akin, who seems so incredibly out of touch, stupid, and hateful of women? And, I don't think that that's an inaccurate assessment, but I do think that it's an uncharitable assessment. And I think that we begin to love Todd Akin if we can reframe the experience that we have in response to his ignoble statement by finding a way to be caring and not hypercritical. How can we love and tolerate? I know that toleration is a word that gets an awful lot of play, but I find the word tolerate to be nearly intolerable. And the reason that I do is because toleration is really about ignoring. I think it's about no one changing, and if we're going to get anywhere in this country, and in conflicted situations in which we find ourselves, it's going to be because we change, because all of us change. And so I guess we love Todd Akin, or we begin to love him if we can find a way of framing that experience in a way that allows for his humanity to be part of it. How can one be a skeptic and also be spiritual? I don't know. I've always been a skeptic, and I've always been spiritual, and I guess I don't see them as in any way being opposed to each other. Last week, I gave a sermon about magical experiences, for those of you who were here, and I can't explain any of those. I have to be very skeptical about how they came to pass. And yet, each of them put me in as deeply a spiritual place as any experience in life would. And those of you who weren't here, there are copies of that sermon on the backboard, and I'll refer to it as the larger answer to this question. How do, should you use, think about what happens after death? I gotta pull the word should, because I'm not going to tell anybody how they should, feel about what happens after death? How do you youths feel about what happens after death? I think to a significant extent, what have we got in the room here, about 70 people? My guess is there are probably about 70 different answers residing in this room at this point in time. And so how do you youths think about death is in many ways. We think about it in many ways. You know, I can share with you what I think, and that is there's a poem I sometimes use in memorial services about, I heard a good person say that unless a person believed in an afterlife, they had lived for no reason at all during this life. And the poet goes on to say, then I find life to be much like a piece of strawberry shortcake. You know, the cake itself is so rich and good, and the whipped cream could be no more luscious. And put a cherry on top of it if you want to, God, but if you don't, it's okay. The strawberry shortcake has been perfect just as it is. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, that's what it is about life. We know that we're going to die, and so, you know, let's love life. Let's love life as much as we possibly can. If there is a will of the universe or divine plan or some other purpose larger than ourselves, how do we know if our intentions and actions are in alignment with it or not? Great question. People go to seminary for just this question. I'm delighted to say this person is not asking me if I believe whether or not there is a will of the universe, but just if there is, how do we know if our intentions or actions are in alignment or not? And I have to say that for me, Frederick Buechner made a statement, which was, when the needs of the world coincide with the passions of our heart, we have found our ministry. And I think that for me, the answer to this question is, when in my heart I feel that I'm aligned with whatever energy is about, then I feel like I am working with whatever will there might be in the universe. I told most of you the story of how I recognized my call to ministry in the middle of a worship service. I'm hit by its ministry, and an hour and a half later, I say nothing. An hour and a half later, my wife and I are walking to the car in the parking lot of the church at the Unitarian Congregation in Davenport, Iowa, and my wife says, "So, what are you going to do about it now?" And in the next couple of weeks, friends coming out of the woodwork to say, "I've been thinking about you in the ministry." You know, I think that that was so blatant, you know, but I was 37, and if there's a will of the universe, it had waited long enough, and it was going to hit me over the head with this clearly, clearly, clearly until I got it. You know, but I think that there are other kinds of signals that tell us when we're in alignment, and that we need to pay attention to those, and that we can only know that we're in alignment if we take the time to pay attention. And this is the last question. What is the nature of explaining trauma in nature and people? We're born to life in pain, I think, through that initial experience of separation. None of us are going to get out of this alive, and anything that's organic in this world is going to change forms, because that's the deal we subscribe to when we get born, that we're not going to get out of this alive, and that everything changes. And change sometimes creeps in, and change is sometimes traumatic. And what is the nature of explaining trauma? The nature of explaining trauma, I think, comes to us from religious messages from time immemorial, which say to us that whatever trauma we may face, our task is to find, even in the midst of it, the hope that will take us to our next step, or to the next possibility of transcendence or transformation, so that we can once again become larger than the pain or the trauma that we've been experiencing. And I think on that one, we've reached the end of the questions. I hope that you feel yours was addressed in a way that gave it the respect that it deserved.